Every 4 years, the Utah Foundation surveys the people of this state to determine what are their greatest concerns. This information is meant to help drive the priorities of policymakers and civic leaders. In both 2016 and 2020, Utahns told us that their number one concern was health care costs and access. The past year in particular has highlighted the great importance of our health care services and infrastructure, but it has also brought forth opportunities for new means to address both health care costs and access. Recently, Utah Foundation held a breakfast briefing focused on providing a fresh look at how we can address healthcare challenges. As part of that conversation, we were joined by three leaders on the front lines. You'll hear their insights in this edition of Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Peter Reichard.
First, we'll hear from Dan Lillenquist about efforts to control one of the biggest cost drivers, pharmaceuticals. Dan is Senior Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer at Intermountain Healthcare. He's the lead architect and board chair of Civica RX, a nonprofit initiative to produce affordable generic medications. Dan?
Civica is an initiative that launched in September of 2018, but it's actually an idea that I had coming up on 5 years ago at a treadmill at the gym in Bountiful. I've been writing a column for the Deseret News, and I wrote about the challenges with EpiPen. And it bothered me that epinephrine, which has been on the market for well over 100 years and costs $1 a dose to make, that Mylan, a generic drug company, had marked the price up for a two-pack of EpiPen to $600 and pointed to the entire drug supply chain as the issue. As an econ guy myself, I thought that feels wrong to me. And it bothered me that drugs that particularly that had made it through their patented life and were clearly in the public domain, that certain companies had been able to corner those products and really raise the price on desperate families who could barely afford their medications. And so I thought, you know, it's probably unlikely the federal government has the ability or even the interest to seriously regulate drug prices and regulate this market more effectively. So I had this idea, you know, why not create a nonprofit generic drug company that would work with health systems and with payers to really systematically work to repair the generic drug market and look for opportunities to take formulas that, again, were clearly in the public domain and return them to the public domain, essentially make sure that these drugs were within reach of ordinary people. So we launched Civica in September of 2018, about a couple of years later, and fast forward to today, we have over 1,400 hospitals involved in the Civica project, well over a third of the hospitals in the United States. And we now produce 50 drugs with Civica and have treated 14 million patients and growing. And it's been a wonderful endeavor. What we've been able to do, the mission of Civica is really simple, is to ensure that essential medicines are available and affordable to everyone. And what we've been able to do is not only stabilize the supply of these drugs, which many of them had run into short supply, because the way a monopoly maximizes its profits is you restrain supply, then you find out how desperate people are for your product. We've not only been able to, for the 50 drugs that we've already targeted, been able to stabilize the market for those drugs, stabilize the supply, but also bring down substantially the prices of those drugs. One other thing I will say briefly on Civica is that we're not just stopping with hospital drugs. And in the coming weeks, we will be announcing the formation of another sister company to Civica that's called Civica Script. And we have 140 million people covered by 20 of the largest payers in the country who are involved in Civica Script. And that'll give us the opportunity to take on things like EpiPen, insulin, and other products that are, frankly, clearly in the public domain and whose prices are out of reach for regular people. So we're just getting started with Civica. I serve as the board chair of both Civica and Civica Script, the new outpatient company that we're starting. And it's been very fun for me to see an idea that came to me on a treadmill at a gym and to see 5 years later where we are. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Peter.
Thank you, Dan. Now we'll hear about the public sector cost picture from Sophia DiCaro. Sophia is the new executive director of the Utah Governor's Office of Planning and Budget. Sophia brings expertise in public administration and finance and on Utah's population to the challenges of addressing state Medicaid costs. Welcome, Sophia, and thank you for your office's ongoing cooperation with Utah Foundation in our research efforts.
No, well, thank you, and thanks for the introduction and for the opportunity to participate. Some of you may know that our office was recently reorganized and was renamed to the Governor's Office of Planning and Budget. Our new administration is focused on enhancing statewide planning coordination with long-term vision, and entities like Utah Foundation are certainly key partners in ensuring that we retain what makes Utah such a great place to live, work, and play. And as the administration took office, the governor and lieutenant governor released a document called the One Utah Roadmap. I have it right here. And in that document, we discussed the need to increase our health security, both COVID-related and otherwise. And we're committed to efforts to increase transparency in health costs, transition to value-based services, and address social determinants of health to decrease our healthcare costs long-term. As we all know, the cost of healthcare is not an issue limited to government. We're lucky to have excellent partners in the state of Utah, like Utah Foundation, as we seek to make healthcare more accessible and improve overall health outcomes. As it relates to Medicaid spending, Medicaid's relevance as a social safety program has been increasing both nationally in Utah and over the past several decades. For example, back in 1998, about 6% of Utah's population was enrolled in some form of Medicaid coverage. And by 2020, more than 10% of Utah's population was enrolled in Medicaid coverage. So that gives you an idea of just how much it has changed over the years. And there's been some notable program developments in the Medicaid program that explain some of this, but the home and community-based limited service waivers is one. The Affordable Care Act, which drove the transition of children from the Children's Health Insurance Program to the traditional Medicaid program. And then expansion of Affordable Care Act Medicaid benefits to Utah adults that make up 138% of the federal poverty level as of January 2020. So this expanded Medicaid footprint has also been mirrored on the fiscal side of the equation as well. So Utah's Medicaid general fund expenditures have increased pretty substantially over the years. 1998, Medicaid made up about 13% of general fund spending, which was $188 million at the time. And then by fiscal year 2019, it represented 32% of general fund spending at about $727 million, to give you an idea of how much that has changed. And in 2020, there were some changes to the federal match rate due to the Families First Coronavirus Response Act that pushed that percentage down to about 25% of all general fund spending. But nevertheless, the trend continues to make up a great deal of our general fund spending. So as it relates to Medicaid expansion, just to quickly recap the last expansion efforts. In 2019, Senate Bill 96 enacted Medicaid expansion in response to a fall 2018 ballot initiative that was approved by the voters by a margin of 53 to 47. And the expansion extended benefits to all Utah adults under 138% of the federal poverty level. And voters also voted for a tax increase along with that expansion. And so the Senate Bill 96 included that sales tax increase. However, the revenue from the earmarked sales tax from that bill was never enough to pay for the full cost of expansion. There was a gap there in the funding. So in addition to the earmark that the state put in place as a result of that bill, $13.6 million in hospital assessment revenue was allotted to plug that gap. And then nearly $56 million of ongoing general fund was pulled away to plug that gap. Now that had changed over the past couple of years, but where the money was taken out in 2020, but restored in 2021. But that gives you an idea of how much in addition to that bill had to be pulled away. Now to understand the full cost picture, it's important to review the evolution of accountable care organizations, or what we call ACOs. When Dan Lilienquist served in the Utah State Senate, he sought to address Medicaid cost escalation in 2011 following the Great Session, and we're grateful to him for the contributions he made back then that exist today. He created a new Medicaid budget buffers that we still have in place today, and that's the Medicaid Growth Reduction and Stabilization Account, in addition to the risk-sharing capitated payment framework for what would later become our state's accountable care organization structure. So accountable care organizations now serve 77% of Medicaid enrollees, replacing fee-for-service models for physical health benefits across most areas of the state. And in recent efforts have included the integration of ACO-led physical as well as behavioral health services for some expansion populations in attempt to provide a whole person care to improve health outcomes and reduce costs. And so going forward, we anticipate the state will continue to support ACOs and ensure that mechanisms for annual appropriations and rates allow all parties to benefit from the cost avoidance that comes from effective care. But with respect to long-term outlook, medical inflation continues to outpace general inflation, which we anticipate will increase costs. The current statutory framework for ACO capitation payments helps, but more needs to be done to contain those costs. Medicaid should serve as a bridge to employer-sponsored coverage for able-bodied beneficiaries who engage in the workforce. And we'll continue to work with federal partners to maintain waiver approval to implement community engagement requirements for our state's existing expansion program. As we learn more about the importance of addressing the social determinants of health, the state will also prioritize an approach to the whole person care, which we're doing in partnership with many others, including the folks on this call. And this will help improve overall health outcomes and hopefully reduce the misutilization of Medicaid resources overall. But that gives you kind of a picture of the cost challenges that we face with the state. And with that, I'll turn the time back over to you.
Thank you, Sophia. Now let's look at the broader picture. Andrew Croshaw is CEO of Levitt Partners, a national healthcare intelligence firm founded by former Utah Governor and HHS Secretary Mike Levitt. Andrew is a national leader and expert on healthcare policy, economics, and value. Andrew, very pleased to have you with us today.
Peter, thank you. Any Utah business, whether you're in healthcare or not, regardless, you can't separate yourself from the industry dynamics that are characterizing the operating environment. And healthcare is no different than that. So I'll share just a few remarks today about what are the big drivers in the industry of cost and access, and look forward to talking about some of the solutions right here in Utah and nationally to address this. Everybody knows that year over year, healthcare costs are rising faster than GDP. And the consequence, of course, of that is that over time, healthcare spending crowds out spending on other important societal priorities. They take a bigger and bigger share of our economy. So the question is, why is this happening? Are we just consuming too much healthcare, or are we paying too much for the healthcare that we consume? This is a topic that's been studied quite a bit, and understanding it is really part of getting to the solution. The answer simply is that we're paying too much. In fact, when you look at consumption, and there are many ways to look at healthcare consumption, but when you look at consumption, on average, the US, people average about 4 doctor visits per year. Now, of course, we all know people who go to the doctor many, many times, and others who maybe don't go to the doctor for a few years. But on average, in the US, it's just under 4 doctor visits per year. You might be surprised to know that that's well below the average of doctor visits that happen in other industrialized countries. They are at about 7 visits per year. And yet healthcare spending in the US is at $11,000 per year per capita on average, $11,000 per person. And in those same countries, the average is just over 4,000. So we have almost half the doctor visits and we're spending almost twice the amount. Let me give you a couple of examples. We have surgery here in the United States, and guess what? People have those same surgeries in other industrialized countries. So we can look at the cost of that. The average cost of a surgical procedure in our country is twice the cost of the same procedure in the next costliest country. Isn't that amazing? The average cost of an appendectomy in the US will be about $16,000 compared to the UK of $8,000. That's the next most expensive, and it just gets cheaper from there. The average bypass surgery in the US will cost about $78,000. In other industrialized countries, like Switzerland, for example, it's $34,000. Let's look at drugs. Dan talked a little bit about a really important solution, a groundbreaking solution that he and Intermountain have helped pioneer with regard to generic drugs and their availability and supply chain manipulation. Well, when we look at branded drugs, those drugs for which IP patents still exist, the US is spending about double the cost of the next costliest country. I'll give you an example. Xarelto, it's a common blood clot medication. It's $292 in the US, it's $126 in the UK. This cost problem is not just maddening from a policy perspective, it's actually bankrupting us. Our deficit spending in this country has endured largely interrupted since the late 1960s. And when we study what the main drivers to deficit spending are, and of course, deficit spending is spending more every year than we take in tax receipts, it's Medicare, it's Medicaid, and it's Social Security. And this is why it's such a big priority for Sophia and for Governor Cox, is to make good use of these scarce resources to help to do as much good as we can. Right now, of course, with deficit spending, we know that things are particularly bad and it's a pandemic and it's a one-time thing. And we know that we need to really throw resources at helping our economy get back on its feet, helping families and so forth. In fiscal year 2020 for the federal government, the deficit is about $3 trillion. For fiscal year 2021, it's supposed to be $3.4 trillion. Now, those numbers are so big that it's hard to even put them in context. Well, if I told you that the total tax receipts that the federal government received is less than $4 trillion, then all of a sudden you can put a $3.5 trillion deficit in perspective. We are overspending almost to the tune of double what we're taking in. Now, of course, this is an unusual situation. It's a pandemic, as I talked about. But the problem of deficit spending has been ongoing for decades. And guess what? It's projected to continue. That will affect all areas of spending in this country as we increasingly rely on borrowing. Let's talk a minute just about social spending. I'm talking about things like employment, food security, housing, education, mobility, those kinds of things. The US is much closer to other industrialized countries when it comes to that kind of spending. And interestingly, a greater proportion of social spending in this country comes from private sources, which is really, I think, encouraging and shows the kind of commitment and attention that this topic has. So we need to reconstruct the healthcare industry incentives to reward value, exactly as Sophia talked about and exactly as Dan's demonstrated. And we also need to figure out how to thoughtfully address social services spending together with healthcare services to get the outcomes that our society really wants. And we have to do it with less money. And if we don't, then we face the peril that every country faces who chronically outspends its means. And that's not a place where a country like the US that wants to remain economically strong, militarily strong, socially strong wants to be. This is what the mission of Levitt Partners is to do, is to improve health by advancing value. And really grateful to be participating in this conversation with you today. So Peter, back to you.
What do we understand about access to public social services and outcomes for public health? Andrew, you want to start on that?
I think this is a problem that many social scientists have known for decades. It's not a new discovery, but thankfully, this connection between social services spending and healthcare delivery has become much more in the limelight, much more in the fore the last several years. And I think one of the reasons that's the case is that that healthcare delivery systems are increasingly held accountable for health outcomes. And as they are held accountable for health outcomes, they're looking to what are the drivers of health outcomes. And we're finding that social contributors have a great impact on health outcomes. A person's access to education, interpersonal violence in the home, food security, transportation deficits, those kinds of things actually affect healthcare spending rather dramatically. And so this is why the challenge is, if we really want to get a hold on out of control healthcare spending, and we really want to provide value for patients, we've got to figure out how to meld these things better, put more emphasis into social services, both access and the quality of those services. And as a society, we'll begin to see benefits on the health spending side as people are living healthier, more productive lives.
The big question right now is what the pandemic has taught us about our health systems and Medicaid. Sophia, what's been your observation? And I guess one question to think about is maybe how we've differed from other states in terms of the number of people moving on to Medicaid for economic reasons. And of course, we have a more youthful population, but curious to know your thoughts on all that.
Sure. Well, first, we should be extremely proud of our response to this once in 100-year pandemic event, with members of the healthcare community deserving our utmost gratitude. We successfully managed hospital bed capacity, effectively deployed innovative therapeutics as they engaged and emerged as it stands to have the second lowest COVID-19 fatality rate in the country. With vaccinations continuing to scale, over 80% of Utahns now over the age of 60 have received at least one dose. And so, you know, hopefully next year we can have this event in person. I think in terms of how we're doing, we also took steps to open the economy sooner than other states did in a measured way. We saw enrollments increase due to that. We initially were seeing enrollments down right before the pandemic hit and had over budgeted initially. When the pandemic hit, we saw enrollments increase and then subsequently had to pull in more funding to help to pay for what we saw as increased enrollment. We think the Utah compared to the rest of the states is certainly faring out better than most from a fiscal side of things. You know, we were proactive in pulling aside budget, making cuts, and now we're in a position to expedite healthcare needs even more so.
Dan, from the inside of a health system, you know, what are some of the big things that you all have learned and observed over the past year, whether in terms of opportunities or vulnerabilities?
Well, I think it's been a remarkable year. You know, Sophia mentioned that Utah is the second lowest death rate in the country from COVID-19, but I would also say it had the third most open economy. And so what I think our governor and our legislative leaders have tried to do is balance the economic health of the state with the you know, obviously working through a pandemic at the same time. And we've seen, you know, our regular tensions that we've had through that process. But at the same time, I don't think there's a better state, better example of a true partnership between the government and the healthcare industry and business leaders. I think we came out probably as well or better than anybody. What I've really appreciated watching is what our community has done to support us. I mean, you know, during our shortage last year of PPE, in partnership with the University of Utah and Latter-day Saint Charities, Intermountain Healthcare initiated a project to locally manufacture PPE. And we were able to make 6 million masks with 50,000 volunteers in a period of 6 weeks. It's just truly a remarkable achievement. And that's the credit to the community as they stepped up to help during what is a pretty difficult time. I also think it's pretty remarkable to see how we, across the large health systems in this state, really worked to triage patient loads so that we didn't have specific hospitals getting overwhelmed. We didn't have the situation they had in New York where patients were dying simply because they didn't have, you know, caregivers there to turn them over in bed, et cetera. That has been an unprecedented coordination and collaboration all the way from managing the availability of ECMO machines, which are kind of heart-lung bypass there's a limited number of those in the state. I think we've done a good job as anybody really in coordinating across, again, the government, community, and with the hospital systems to make sure we're prioritizing the saving of lives. And all of us are gonna know people that have died from COVID, but many of us know people who survived after being hospitalized. And that's, I think, a credit to this state and how we work together. I think one of the things that from a healthcare perspective that we've realized and we're very grateful for is that, you know, people are now questioning whether or not just-in-time inventory makes a lot of sense in healthcare. And gratefully, Intermountain has tried to have a very robust supply chain approach that kept us safe. But I don't know of a single instance in this entire state where we had a caregiver caring for a COVID-19 patient who didn't have all of the required PPE that they needed to be safe themselves. The other thing I would say that COVID-19 has done is really accelerated the adoption of telemedicine, which is quite promising in our perspective about the future of healthcare and healthcare costs, that maybe we can start shifting healthcare out of more expensive environments into less restrictive, less expensive places. So with that, I mean, I could go on, but I'll leave it there.
Thanks, Dan. I'm curious to know, looking at the national picture where we're hearing discussions lately about cost controls on pharmaceuticals, we have heard in recent years about this idea that the United States is subsidizing all those countries that do have cost controls because we pay full freight. To the extent that that's true is a question. And then in this national context, you know, how do we deal with these challenges politically?
So, Peter, I'm going to perhaps a little bit controversial here. And I just spoke about this at the Vatican Health Conference just a couple of weeks ago. This data comes from the West Health Organization out of San Diego. But over the next decade, if you take $1 trillion off of the projected margins that pharma is expected to earn over the next decade, $1 trillion, they would still be the most profitable sector in the entire economy. And what bothers me about drug costs, if you think about containing costs, there's one area where health systems are almost totally incapable of containing costs, and that's on the drug side. The pharmaceutical lobby, they have created a back door into the federal treasury unlike any other group. I can't think of another example. I mean, think about it. They get to set the prices on the federal government for Medicare and Medicaid. Now there's a prescribed discount for Medicaid, you know, of 13% or whatever it is. But there's a discount. So they get the best price. But if the price is five times higher than what it should be, and you're given a 13% discount, it's just not that good of a deal. And I challenge anybody to identify any other sector of the economy that gets to unilaterally set its prices on the federal government. Healthcare doesn't get to do that. We don't get to go and say to, you know, to CMS that we're going to tell you what you're going to pay us on Medicare. It's absolutely ridiculous to me. And frankly, it's destabilizing. Now, when people say, hey, we subsidize drug development for the rest of the world, that is not an overt policy decision that the federal government has made. They're making that decision because we essentially don't negotiate for anything. In the very start, Medicare and Medicaid should be able to negotiate for drug prices for branded drugs. I mean, that's, to me, it has to happen. Now that the reason why we actually developed Civica is because, you know, frankly, the easiest money to raise in Washington is from drug companies. They literally can just raise the price on the federal government to pay for the lobbying efforts. So, you know, when we looked at Civica and looked and said, is the federal government really capable of fixing market failures on the generic side? You know, I just basically had no hope that would happen. And that's why we came up with a free market approach to do it through Civica. But what I think you'll see is that stress and strain, eventually we'll wake up one day and realize that we cannot let a subsector of the economy have direct control over the future finances of the country. And that is exactly what's happening. This is not a partisan issue, it shouldn't be, but it's very much a money issue. And until we actually recognize this, the threat this is to all of our social programs, We're going to be heading down and continue down a very difficult path. That's just my perspective. Now, on the generic drug side, we feel like we can handle that. What we're doing with Civica and with what we're doing with the hospitals and payers, we're going to solve those issues. But the branded space is one that frankly, it's asinine to me to expect to be able to lower costs of healthcare when you have a whole sector that feels totally unconstrained, and because they are effectually unconstrained.
Thanks, Dan. Andrew, what are your thoughts on this?
I think Dan's laid out the case pretty well. And what we see that the issue of controlling drug costs has become bipartisan. Despite the bipartisanship, though, we haven't seen a major action. It is a highly political issue. And it's also a topic about which we need to be very thoughtful. All of us want the innovation that comes from biopharma. All of us want those products. And so finding that balance of incentives that rewards society and rewards the company, and we're not in balance today, and Dan's made, I think, a compelling case for that, but finding that balance is going to be critical. I expect that there will be action on this, and it won't be in one one swooping kind of thing. It will be a series of actions that take place that enable more negotiation and more price pressure. And I also hope that we recognize that by itself won't solve the crisis that we're in. It's a big area of spend, but it's not the heart of the problem. It's an indication of the fact that we don't have the right incentives in place for healthcare actors to create value for their constituencies. And so it's an important step on the road, though.
On that incentives question and how to get things aligned, I'll go to you first, Sophia, on this. Are there opportunities that we can explore to create better harmony between providers and insurers or Medicaid?
The things that Dan's working on right now are revolutionary and really have the opportunity to change the paradigm and to be kind of this shift that we need on that cost side. I mentioned earlier, there are many variables at play here, and that's certainly one of them. You know, we could be super, super healthy people and have one ailment and it would still be out of control costs. And so I think that what can be done to support those kinds of efforts, to support increased transparency around what's happening and around the regulatory framework that's involved, there's certainly opportunity to look at that and see what can be done there, but also take a deeper look at the things that are happening with Civica and the things that they're working on and how we can push that out as a national model. And it's just exciting to see that that's happening here in the state.
Sophia, just to pile on to that comment, I think it's interesting that the solution that is today Civica, it didn't come from a drug wholesaler. It didn't come from the federal government. It came from a nonprofit integrated health system. We should not lose sight of that where are the solutions going to come from? And they won't come from just one sector, but we've got to have leadership from organizations who have the incentive to serve the community's interest. And I think that the one that you just highlighted and the one that we're talking about here is a great example of the kind of leadership that we need on value. And we need a whole bunch more solutions like that, that begin to fix the incentives.
Yes, and if I may, Andrew, I just think government's not going to be able to solve all of these issues here, just because there are so many variables at play. And we really are going to need to lean more heavily on non-governmental partners like nonprofits, as you suggested, and with the private sector to step up and help solve this problem so that we can fix the way this whole structure is trending.
Andrew, we've heard from many of our friends in the healthcare arena about an explosion of telehealth over the past year, exponential growth in telehealth. Where do you see that panning out longer term? I mean, obviously, a big part of that is a response to the current circumstances, but where does it pan out? What kind of opportunities does that present for us in terms of cost and access?
The trend of telehealth, that predates the pandemic. But what the pandemic did in so many ways was accelerate existing trends dramatically. And telehealth is a great example of that. There were a number of organizations already providing the service. Some doctors were already using it. Some patients were already using it. But we saw explosive growth and experimentation, both with the clinicians and the patients, and also on the payment side. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but so many problems of our broken system come back to how the system is set up to with incentives. When the payers historically have thought about telehealth, they're really afraid of being abused. A whole bunch of reimbursement claims coming in for all these telehealth visits, and they're wondering, wow, are we really providing value to patients, or are we just churning, you know, the industrial complex here? And so in a fee-for-service system, that telehealth reimbursement has been very slow, and there's been a lot of regulation about it. The pandemic created an emergency where we couldn't think about that, and it gave us a chance to experiment with it. And what we're learning is that physicians like it better than they thought they would, and that there's a place for it with consumers. And we're seeing a greater willingness of regulators to enable some telehealth permissions to extend. We're still stuck with the problem of how do you prevent abuse? And if we have an environment in which the reimbursement and the cost of care is part of a bundle for taking care of a patient, then all of a sudden the government or a private payer doesn't have to worry about being abused. And in fact, I'll give an example. There was a fully capitated physician group I'm aware of in Florida that was already taking monthly risk-adjusted payments to take care of a population. They were up and running with telehealth in less than a week. They didn't have to ask for permission. They didn't have to worry about whether they were going to get paid. They just had motivation to use that system to help people, and they were being paid on a global level for that. It's a great example of where telehealth fits seamlessly into a value-based healthcare system, but it rubs in a fee-for-service payment system because of the fear of abuse.
Now, Peter, may I jump in and add on to that? Telemedicine, Andrew is exactly right with respect to the incentives around telemedicine. Intermountain has been pioneering telemedicine for years now, but partly because of our strong relationship with Select Health, about half of our revenue, about 45% of our revenue at Intermountain Healthcare comes through fully capitated arrangements, including Medicaid. And that just resolves a lot of the concerns. If you can have a telemedicine visit that avoids an emergency department visit, every dollar of cost reduction is a dollar of value creation. With respect to Medicaid, you know, that allows us to live underneath a really hard Medicaid cap on the Medicaid growth rate on a per member per month basis. But it also allows us to, you know, to innovate and to fund our mission. We've got to move, if we're going to move healthcare forward, our hypothesis is in Intermountain, we've got to move away from transactional interactions to more of a value-focused model. And in a value-focused model, innovation can really occur quickly. I'll just give you one example. What we started to do during the pandemic was we realized when a patient showed up at a hospital with COVID, for example, or with other issues, that we could triage them in the emergency room, send them home with oxygen and through some remote monitoring tools, and essentially check in with them via telemedicine with a hospitalist. That way they could be safe at home, we could monitor their vitals, we could have excellent care via telemedicine, and we weren't putting them in our hospitals, in our ICUs, or we could actually extend our ICUs to kind of other step-down units. It helped us alleviate the concerns. Intermountain was able to move quickly on that stuff because, frankly, it was never a question of whether or not we were getting paid. A lot of that was, we're already been paid for majority of those patients. We've taken a capitated arrangement. And that's just so important. Our strategy is very simple at Intermountain. Our mission is to help people live the healthiest lives possible. We believe the best expression of that mission is when we can take full clinical and financial accountability for populations of people over a longitudinal period of time. And every time we can help them resolve their own concerns or use telemedicine or really digital tools to self-treat, to self-diagnose, et cetera, to self-navigate, and to get them into the least restrictive, lowest cost environments, that's how we create value, not only for the health system, but for society at large. So what I'm hoping is this move into telemedicine will accelerate the move into value-based arrangements with more and more providers, because in that alignment, we have the, I think that's really quite honestly our only hope to really bend the healthcare cost trends. Otherwise, our alternatives, if we remain in a transactional environment, is that governments are going to have to lower rates and question everything that providers do. And that's just not a productive environment for reform.
Thank you, Dan. I'm going to grab a question from the audience here at random. We have one about addressing mental health care. We can't talk about health care and access without addressing mental health. And there was some discussion about costs, even with insurance. The question is, how do we address the issue of mental health costs so there aren't these financial burdens that come along with it? Are there some things that we can look at in the Medicaid arena to begin with? Sophia?
I know that the ACL model has already started to embrace this concept of including mental health. We also know we have this social determinants of health concept that is starting to be embraced by our community as a whole as well, which takes those types of things into, you know, as we contemplate what health means, to include mental health as part of that discussion. And we're also seeing this trend nationally as well. Just to give you an example of the ARP money, the federal dollars coming in for this third tranche of coronavirus money, we're seeing, you know, allowances with some of that to also embrace this concept of including mental health and acknowledging that should be part of the picture, and that should be in part of this dialogue as we talk more about health in general. So I think that the environment is changing such that we are acknowledging this should be part of the conversation as well. I think there's more openness than I've ever seen to this idea and to including it. And I think more work will be done. Now on the cost side, yeah, that's always the challenge, right? But again, I think that the things that are happening in partnership, kind of what Andrew and Dan mentioned beforehand, and just the, you know, non-governmental partners stepping up to the plate in approaching the social determinants of health, we're seeing more of that happen. And I suspect we'll continue to see more of that happen. This pandemic it showed us all that mental health is part of the picture, and that we should look at this more holistically.
A question for Dan and Andrew. This is paraphrasing a question from Courtney at the Health Policy Project. What is the role of state legislatures in dealing with pharmaceutical costs?
It's pretty tough to do at the state level. I've loved all the efforts that the legislature has taken on trying to make insulin prices fair, affordable, and transparent. You know, this is clearly interstate commerce, and so it clearly is a federal issue, and it's hard to do that to really address it at the state level, except for awareness and understanding. You know, the thing that that Civica is going to take on next is really the opaqueness of the outpatient model, where you have drugs that that for cash pay patients are literally hundreds of dollars because of the way the PBM's contracting works. What the pharmacy benefit managers, and there's three of them, who control the vast majority of the country, what they require pharmacies to do is to mark their cash price up to a certain amount so they can create the headroom for rebates back to payers and back to PBMs. And what that does is it puts enormous pressure on the people who can least afford their medications to pay the highest prices. I'll give you just one example. Insulin, Lantus, as a basal insulin, it's been, you know, off patent for 20 years. The cash price of Lantus is over $300 if you want to go buy a 10 ml vial of Lantus. The contract price that most payers pay is well under 100. And the manufacturing costs of Lantus are less than 10. So what's happened is that the supply chain for drugs has become so convoluted and so backwards. It's really about expressing market power over pricing, even over drugs that are clearly, again, past their patented life. And so what Civica is working on doing is we believe that there should be one transparent price, should be a cash price, the same as a contract price for payers. So we're working with large retailers and with our consortium of 140 million people covered by 20 large payers to deconstruct this rebate model and to make sure that the cash price that's available at Walmart is the same as the contract price that payers pay. And what we think that'll do is alleviate a lot of suffering. We think if we do this right, we should be able to put affordable insulin on the shelves, at large retailers for hopefully in the $25 to $30 range instead of $300. But that model is just, the PBMs created the highway between the manufacturers and the customers. Again, the pharmacy benefit managers, and then they become highwaymen, controlling access and really taking excess profits along the way. And the saddest thing is they're grinding the poor, the sick into poverty. And that's something that is just wrong. And we think we have a free market solution to fix that. But these are some of the things that's just grown up over time. And we've just assumed that this is just how the market works and it doesn't need to work this way.
Andrew, thoughts on the role of state legislatures?
Yeah, I really appreciate what Dan had to say. And I'll just add that we ask a lot of a part-time legislature to come in and be experts on many industries and on the complex interplay inside those industries. And I don't think it's legitimate to ask the legislature to solve sort of multivariable complex challenges by themselves. I would like to see a commission-like system imbued with some authority by the executive branch to study an issue, to come back with recommendations, and to have some type of authority that doesn't transcend the legislative role, but that helps supplement, I think, what is a really sincere motivation by the legislature, but difficult to get the whole body or enough of the body up to the level of education and have the time to really solve that. Outside of that, I think we just need to rely on the federal government to do their part and the kind of innovation in the private sector that we've been talking about.
Sophia, a question from Chad Westover. You mentioned that there's a misutilization of Medicaid spending in Utah. How should the state better direct Medicaid spending? Where are the costs for healthcare just outpacing overall inflation growth?
Yes, and maybe that was a poor choice of words, that we have a system without really being able to grip the types of outcomes we want, really driving the outcomes we want. So that's what was meant by that terminology there. And so what we want to do is try to get better at figuring out how to drive the outcomes we want with the limited dollars we have. That's the challenge, right? Which is why I appreciate so much what Andrew just mentioned, is that it's got to be a partnership. We have a part-time legislature. We have limited resources that we're talking about. We have one of the fastest growing states in the nation. We are going to continue to have those demands coming, and it's complex. And so what we need to do is make sure we're being as effective as we can with the limited resources we have, and try to make sure we're getting the outcomes that we want with the limited dollars we have there.
Andrew, if you could give us a quick answer, we've got time for one more question about administrative costs. Are there opportunities to bring administrative costs under control?
Yeah, I mean, it's been well documented. We have a lot of administrative costs in the system. There's a lot of consolidation going on, some of it positive to address that. It's just a characteristic of the system that we have, a whole lot of what you might euphemistically call middlemen in the system. It doesn't have to be that way, but changing it gets at the type of change that we're talking about. It's a significant number. Some organizations estimate it to be 30% of healthcare spending, depending on how you look at it. So there's definitely a lot going on. All of us have experienced that as patients with the confusion that we have, the number of phone calls, inquiries, emails on costs, and trying to understand and be part of that, it's maddening for us as consumers as well.
Thanks to Andrew Croshaw, Sophia DeCaro, and Dan Lillenquist for the insights this morning. Thanks again to Intermountain Healthcare for its generous sponsorship of this breakfast briefing. And thanks to all of you for being with us. We hope this has been informative.
This has been Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. Follow our work at utahfoundation.org.